Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, how are you doing, Phil? Everything good with you?
Yeah, super fantastic. I'm looking forward to my few weeks off here coming up, leading up to the world transformed. We'll be talking a little bit about what's going on there, but we weren't sure actually that I was going to be on tonight. So I'm very pleased to be here, very pleased for the circumstances of my imminent departure from the program for a few weeks, and also very excited about what I'll be coming back to. So, you know, I mean, that's what being super fantastic is all about. Yeah. And speaking
You're
of super
a glass
fantastic,
half full God.
The glass is totally full. What are you talking about? And speaking of super fantastic, I want to introduce my other co-host, PJ Manny, is with us this evening. PJ, what a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, gentlemen. It is a wonderful pleasure as always.
Well, we are glad to have you. And the thing I need to report, I guess, is this is from the Department of Partially Kept Promises, Stephen. So here's where I backtrack just a little from being super fantastic. Two things I need to report right out of the gate here before we conduct any other business is one, I promised everyone that PJ would be on this evening, and I've delivered. So there you go. That's partially kept promise. And then Michael Darling would be on, but he's a little under the weather vocally. So Michael is gracing us in the chat room, and we're delighted to have you there, Michael. But we're hoping your voice gets better and that you'll be joining us back here in the virtual studio in the near future.
And he also he contributed some to show content tonight, so he's already done
he will
that.
Be,
so
he will be here in content and in chat, but we won't get to hear his voice until perhaps next week when he's feeling a little bit better. So that's one partially kept promise. My other partially kept promise, somewhat less fulfilled than the first one, which was at least half done, is worldtransform.com. I've got most of the content finished. I just don't have it up yet. My goal was to have it up by Sunday. That didn't quite happen. So I'm really hoping to have it up by Friday, because I can't imagine when it's going up after Friday if that doesn't happen. But I'm really going to pound it out, and I'll put something up on The Speculist as soon as the site's up. I think everyone's going to be very pleased with it, and that's going to be a complete breakdown on the World Transform 2 with bios of all the participants and descriptions of all the shows, and also links to our partners. We're going to be presenting this series in conjunction with some partner organizations, and we're very excited about that, and that will all be announced once I get the website up. So I don't know how I can claim that I've partially delivered on that one, Stephen. It may be that's more from the Department of Broken Promises. What do you think?
No. You're in the process of getting it together. So it's kind of a big deal. We're talking 10 shows. How many guests total did you say? I mean,
we've got 28 confirmed guests right now.
28 confirmed. Okay. So think of for folks in the audience, Phil is putting together 28 biographies, show descriptions. And the list goes on and on. It's huge.
PJ's alone took me, a week. Just
I wish my life were that complex.
Go ahead, Stephen.
I was just saying, yeah, I mean, lots of interesting people like her. So it's a mammoth undertaking, and so you know I'm behind you all the way, Phil.
Well, thanks for backing me up. Can I get further confirmation that I'm okay from you, PJ? That would really make me feel good.
You are more than okay, my friend.
Ah.
You rock.
Ah, that's see.
Go rocks.
We need PJ on a little more often. That's really
that's right.
Okay, well, speaking of things rocking, that's what we're all about this evening. We decided we'd do a totally upbeat show, you know, a real departure for us on the subject of why the optimism. And Stephen, this was your idea. Tell us how you came up with this.
Well, here's the deal. I mean, you don't have to go far to find stuff that's not optimistic. I mean, anywhere else, you're gonna hear the bad news all the time, and we're so totally the other way. I feel every now and then we just need to stop and explain ourselves. Why are we optimistic? And what makes us that way? You know, and the thing is, we actually have some pretty good reasons for being optimistic in spite of the chaos that's swirling around us at the moment. With the economy and various other problems, so I felt like we'll just take a little time tonight to explain why and maybe give some examples, and I thought that'd make a pretty good show. So
I think that'll make a super fantastic show. I'm looking forward to getting into this. And Stephen, since it was your idea, why don't you grace us with the first reason for us to be optimistic?
Okay, medicine, healthcare in general. I am optimistic about healthcare, and that's a funny thing to say these days. I mean, it seems like everybody is pessimistic about healthcare. We can't pay for it with the present system. Then there are people that are just very much against the latest effort to reform healthcare. And then you got but nobody seems to like the way it was before either. Yet here I am very optimistic about where we're going with healthcare, and it's not one party or the other politically. I don't think it's going to come to our rescue. I think it's going to be innovation, and that's going to be the big thing that's going to be a driver, and nobody in either party seems to be picking up on this. You know, I mean, just today in Instapundit, we learned that there are five different synthetic substitutes that different labs are working on for blood. That's pretty awesome. You know, I mean, artificial blood is going to be a very big deal. Last week, Phil, we mentioned, Watson. Watson, the computer system that beat all those champions on Jeopardy, is now going to med school with the help of a lot of med students and other researchers and things are just feeding Watson all kinds of information from medical journals in hopes that we get a computerized Dr. House, okay? And imagine if that computerized Dr.
House without the emotional baggage, right?
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Without the tood, you know, we won't House and leave the snide comments back at the house. But anyway, we can expect generally when we get sick that we're going to get about an average doctor, right? I mean, sometimes we're going to get a really, really good doctor, and then other times we'll get a bad doctor. But generally it's going to be somewhere in the middle. What if your doctor that's somewhere in the middle has in his possession an iPad that's connected to Watson, who is a computerized Dr. House? Okay, I mean that's a big deal. So, I'm reading the book Optimistic Tour of the Future by Mark Stevenson, and in that book he talks about the Personal Genome Project and how huge this is going to be for medicine and the cost of medicine. I'm thinking to myself, well, why exactly do you mention costs? He says, well, in this book he says that what's going on right now is that we have all these drugs that are perfectly good drugs for 99% of the patients that might take it, but that are not allowed to be on the market because 1% would have a problem with it. Hmm. And he says the Personal Genome Project would allow those drugs, all these potential blockbuster drugs, to be brought onto the market because we would be able to identify the patients that can't take it and say, sorry, you can't have this particular drug, but out of 100, you're the one, you can't have this. The other 99 can have it, and it's going to be great for them. And so can you imagine how much money that saves? Put it this way. All the drugs that they try to bring to market, you know, hundreds of drugs they attempt, and only a few make it, and then they have to recoup all the R&D for all those failed drugs with one blockbuster, right? And so
right.
What does that make? It makes a very expensive drug. What if, many, many more of these drugs were able to make it to market? Well, you spread the R&D costs among all those drugs, and the price of drugs comes down. So the price of expertise in medicine is going to go down thanks to things like Watson, and the price of drugs themselves come down. And, I see these things are things that to be excited about the future. I'm optimistic about medicine because of things like this.
I could not agree with you more. I think that, and I think it gets completely overlooked, that the benefits of automation, the scalability and replicability of expertise of actual substances, medicines, and even organic tissue. Right? There's a TED Talk now where a doctor prints a kidney on stage while he's giving his talk. This is a huge sweeping change to how medicine is delivered, to kind of a post scarcity model of medicine that I think that I think is emerging, that is not part of the overall healthcare debate currently. And I think if there was more understanding of the role that technology could play, I think it would help shape that debate significantly. So that's an excellent answer, Stephen. Any commentary on that one, PJ?
Other than the fact that I would have said I was optimistic about the same thing, I think that I couldn't agree more. I think we're in an extraordinary time that may be very frustrating for people who are not keeping up with new developments, because it takes a long time for new developments to hit the market. I think there's a deep frustration from that people go to the hospital, they might hear about these wonderful things, but it takes, a decade or two to get through the FDA pipeline. But that they are coming, that a lot of these marvelous breakthroughs really are coming.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that we really live on the verge of some exciting stuff. And I have one that is related. Mine are all sets of two, and there's kind of a thematic thing around the answers that I'm giving. But my first answer to the question of what there is to be optimistic about was I was going to say eggs and red meat. Okay, that's these are the things that make me optimistic. And let me tell you why. We had David Asprey on. What was that, about a month ago? I guess, Stephen, maybe 6 weeks ago we had him on, talking about hacking the self, about the process of hacking one's own life, basically. And interesting details he gave us on his diet, on his lifestyle, on interacting with his own brain, interacting with his own heart rate. And the fact that we've come, in my lifetime, from a place where it was actually believed when I was a kid, I don't know if this is astounding to people, and maybe it wasn't even that long ago, but it seems like forever ago, it was believed that you shouldn't eat eggs. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm.
That like, eggs, they'll give you a heart attack, they'll kill you. And of course, it turns out that the egg yolk is one of the most nutritious things in the world. And when David was talking about his diet, it was just all this, like, he gets up in the morning, eats half a dozen eggs with coconut oil, and he's eating this huge steak for dinner. And to me, that was just emblematic of how much we have actually learned, and not only how much have we learned as a society, but what's interesting is with this biohacking movement, this kind of self-improve your life movement, you've got individuals kind of taking ownership of their health. So it's not just a matter of, well, everybody knows eggs are bad for you, so I don't eat eggs. He was then having some pretty intense debates with his doctor about vitamin C and that sort of thing, not claiming that he has greater expertise than a doctor, but that he has a greater share of interest in his own health than any particular doctor does, and that he has more knowledge of his own circumstances than any particular doctor does. So I think that just the contrarian nature of what he had to say about how he has made himself you know, so remarkably healthy, and the fact that this process increasingly seems to belong to us, that not only is healthcare something that we're going to see in greater abundance, but it's something that I think we're going to be more personally involved in for ourselves, and that we're going to have much greater control of. I think we're going to be tremendously empowered around ensuring our own health, and that makes me very, very optimistic.
Absolutely.
All right, PJ, you got one for us? I think you got a big one for us.
Well, I'm going to go meta on you guys.
All right.
And in this week's Time magazine, Tali Sharot, who is a neuroscientist, wrote an article called The Optimism Bias. And the point of her article is that optimism is something that we all share, unless one is congenitally depressed and pessimistic. There are some of those people. But by and large, regardless of our culture, of our circumstances, we are more optimistic than we are pessimistic. And I'm optimistic because we have optimism. What I found fascinating is that it's, you know, how evolutionarily important it is, because we tend to find the silver lining in circumstances that if one would step back objectively, one might go, not so good. But by finding the silver lining, it gives us the perseverance to carry on and to look for the alternative that works better for us, or if we have no choice, how to deal with the alternative we have. And that very act, that cognitive act of looking on the bright side, is what's kept our species alive and continuing to strive. Her point is, if we did not have this optimism, we would still be living in caves, huddled together in the dark. It's what lets us go out and find new discoveries to bring back to, you know, to our civilization. What I found
it allows us to imagine better, huh?
It allows us to imagine better and to strive for that better thing, because we don't acknowledge all the things that could go wrong in the act of going to it, you know, in the act of trying to achieve it. And what I found so interesting was this point about how optimism is actually tied with our ability to conceive of the future. So here we are talking about, you know, what is it about the future we find optimistic? But her point is the very fact that humans can imagine ourselves in the future, we undergo mental time travel. And the ability to do this is what grounds the optimism, because when we think of our future, we want to think positively because we want the positive to manifest. So we have this optimism because we can conceive of the future.
Interesting.
The other thing I found fascinating from a neurological standpoint is the reason, one of the many reasons we are also optimistic, is that our brains, our neurons, will encode desirable information that enhance our optimism, but it won't encode undesirable information. So it's the old joke about, you know, women having children more than once because we forgot the pain.
So is it that we live in denial? I mean,
it's a positive denial, and because ultimately, if it gets us up day after day moving forward, that's a good thing. Even though things might be difficult, we're always finding the positive that allows us to function and to survive.
I wonder how we got this way. How did we evolve to be optimistic?
Well, think,
go ahead.
I think of it this way. What if, you got two different tribes? One is completely optimistic and one is completely pessimistic. Which of the two tribes do you think, Phil, would ultimately dominate and their genes would pass down to us? I think that it's the optimistic guys that you know, think of, you know, come up with new ideas. And
I agree.
The optimistic ones are the ones who are going to say, look, we're experiencing a terrible famine. I think there might be more food over the ridge, right? Or there might be more food if we walk down to the river and follow it for a long time, right?
Right.
That's inherently optimistic idea.
Pessimistic guy says, we're just going to die tired, so we might as well just sit here.
Right.
Exactly.
We need to hunker down because things are bad. And when you think about it, that would apply to a group. That would apply to individuals, too. The optimist is even, you know, in pre-human life, and even in, you know, as we were evolving towards humanity, the tendency to have another scenario in your mind, I guess, which is what you're talking about, PJ, this model of the future where things work out, and to work towards that, that's what John Smart would tell us is a developmental optima, right? That's going
yes.
to that's going to increase your chances of reproducing, and something that's just going to be honed over evolution. The more I think about it, there couldn't be much of an evolutionary advantage to being pessimistic. That would
well, exactly. And back to what Stephen was saying, you know, how you look at the world and you can say there are all these pessimistic things. Well, we can look at the world as an entire culture, and the entire culture can be pessimistic, and yet individuals within it are still optimistic. It's not that specific individuals are optimistic. It's that everyone as an individual is optimistic about their personal future, even as they can be pessimistic in general about their collective future, which is, I think, even more remarkable, that we can, in essence, have this cognitive dissonance where we're optimistic for ourselves but pessimistic about everybody else.
About everybody else, yeah. That's kind of funny. You know, I can sort of see that. I can sort of relate to that. But no, I'm
We attorneys, you know, obviously attorneys have this, like, inferiority complex because everybody, you know, has lawyer jokes and everything. But it comes up again and again that everybody thinks that attorneys are awful except for their attorney. They feel
right,
like their
exactly.
attorney, you know, their attorney is out for their interest. Their attorney is a good, solid, moral person who's, you know, and is smart and always seems to know the right answer. It's their attorney that's great. Well, I think it applies to a lot of things, you know. I mean, it might be your congressman. It might, you know, sure, they're all a bunch of crooks except for, you know, my guy, you know.
Who's the one who's acting in your interest, right? Who's the one
exactly,
who's carrying out those scenarios for you? That's interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So we're inherently optimistic. We've evolved to be optimistic, and the downside of that is it makes us like our own lawyer. So
yeah. Yeah. Michael Darling.
Not really, no. But.
Okay.
He doesn't like his own lawyer. Get a new lawyer, Michael. Oh gosh. Oh, speaking of Michael, we should throw one of his answers in.
Absolutely.
Swinging it back to healthcare, he cites AIDS, and I think this is a tremendously valid reason to be optimistic. In less than 30 years, it went from virtual death sentence to chronic and manageable, at least for those who can afford the meds. It's a great example of what can be accomplished in a short time. I mean, you think about that in the late 80s, early 90s, what it, you know, the horrendous implications of developing AIDS compared with what it means to someone today who has access to the medication. It's a world of difference, and it speaks to, I think, how we'll be able to deal with a lot of things in the future that are viewed currently as death sentences or that are viewed as incurable or, you know, otherwise terminal illnesses. Nothing is permanent in the way of destructive diseases. There's always more we can do about them than we realize at the time. And I think that the kind of accelerating change, Stephen, that you were talking about draws us closer and closer to having a lot of things under control the way we've gotten AIDS under control. Actually, one of my scenarios, I believe, was that I don't remember if I put a time frame on this, Stephen, so you keep me honest on this, but within a certain period of time that we would see cancer basically the way we look at diabetes these days, that it would be something that that people get, they manage it, they deal with it, and it's, you know, it's not a pleasant prospect. It's, you know, certainly it has a huge downside to it, but it's not the automatic death sentence that it once was. And I think to a large extent, for a lot of different varieties of cancer, that's true already. But I think we'll probably see that across the board for all types of cancer within the next few years.
I would, if you didn't put a time frame on it, I will, Phil. I'm going to, let me just step out here and say by the end of this decade, I think cancer will be, by and large, a manageable disease by then. So
I will join you on that. And it seems like that was about the time frame we were saying. Weren't we making predictions for by 2020 at that point? We'll have to go back and look in the archives. But that's the thing. You know, we make these predictions. We need to remember them, right? So we
– Yeah.
At least the ones we get right.
Exactly.
We really need we need to be on top of those, for sure. Okay, so we're zipping through our list. We've only each hit our first one. So Stephen, what do you got? What's next?
Okay, the continuing viability of computer innovation. I read just the other day, it was Stuart Standiford writes the Early Warning blog, and he basically went and just started pulling out the data to see whether the latest recession has had any effect on Moore's law. And I mean, the more he shifted through it, the more he realized it's had almost zero impact on Moore's law all the way through the worst aspects and the worst times of this, and even up till now, the innovation keeps coming, and Moore's law continues to operate even in the worst of this recession. So that can only be outstanding news, right? So I invite you to check out that, and I'm going to put the link in the chat room so everybody can check that out. It's he spends a lot of time on the data, so. Take a look at that. The other thing. What about what happens when Moore's law runs out? I mean, you know, we're all told that at some point Moore's law has to give way because electrons are there's only so much room, right? Down there, there's a lot of there's a lot of room at the bottom, but eventually you've got it full, and we keep hearing things like within 10 years or so. It's going to be done. Well, last week, the first commercial quantum computer was sold for $10 million.
Wow!
And that's huge. That is big, big news. We have a non-traditional computer being sold that is able to work on totally new classes of problems, operates in totally new ways, and so.
Hey, Stephen, who spent $10 million on a quantum computer? Who bought one?
Let me click through and let you know.
I would assume someone doing really advanced research of some kind, but well-funded, clearly, if they can afford $10 million.
And they spent a year looking at at the system before they purchased it. So this quantum computer has actually been available for a little while. It's just this is the first one sold. Okay, global security company Lockheed Martin.
Oh, okay. All right.
Bought the quantum computer for a rumored $10 million. So that's not confirmed, but it's thought that they've spent $10 million on this system, which includes maintenance and other services for several years. So there you have it.
Maybe they're going to be developing some kind of really super advanced encryption system or something with that. That's interesting.
Could be. D-Wave 1 is the name of this system. So.
Wow.
There you are.
Okay. Before long, there will be a quantum computer on every desktop, huh? Or no, in every smartphone, I assume. We'll all be carrying
inside
them around.
Inside your head.
I was going to say, exactly, in every brain-computer interface.
Yeah, well, according to Penrose, right, that's what we all got going on anyway, right, that consciousness is occurring at the quantum level. So when we one day reverse engineer the brain as a computer, that might be a quantum computer in its own right. But, you know, Stephen, your point about Moore's law being – recession-proof is not a big surprise for those who read Kurzweil. If you read The Singularity is Near, then you know that his, and I think before that, even in The Age of Spiritual Machines, as he tracks the law of accelerating returns, as he calls it, which predates Moore's law, goes way back into human history, that it seemed to be impervious throughout human history to all manner of ill fortune, right? You'd have wars going on, you'd have plagues, pestilence, tremendous economic upswings, tremendous economic downswings, just all manner of horrible things and good things that can happen throughout human history. And according to Ray, it's been a very consistent upward trajectory. So it's not surprising to me that that Moore's law has stayed consistent, and I will not be surprised at all if it gets handed off to a different substrate or a different supporting technology when we get there.
Absolutely.
Okay. We'll mix up the order a little bit. PJ, you got one?
Sure. I am optimistic that increased communication through both technology and social networking is increasing empathy and expanding the context of what we consider our fellow brothers and sisters and humans.
Okay. That's been a steady march throughout history, hasn't it?
That has been a very steady march. Accelerated in the last 1,000 years, but with storytelling, with actually the novel and printing and the expansion of media. But I'm very optimistic that just sitting back in the last several months watching the Arab Spring, my husband was in Spain last week for the beginnings of La Revolution, though he wasn't there for that reason. But it was right outside his hotel. I'm so fascinated by watching the spread of communication through the internet, through social networking, through cell phone technology, how people are having empathy for each other much more quickly about much more difficult topics. It's fascinating. So I have great optimism that as communication becomes more and more internalized, that we may hopefully have even greater empathy for our fellow human beings. And this is the crazy idealist in me. Hoping that, you know, we can, there'll be less war, less killing, et cetera, because we realize that the people on the other side are not so different from us.
Well, and in fact, there's a whole body of evidence. There's a whole historical line of argument that says that even that much has actually been achieved. That if you look at the big picture over time, we are killing each other less and
yes,
less inclined to do that. It's really interesting to think how technology can play a role in empowering that. And what's the big driver in your view, PJ? What is it that enables people to become more empathetic? Is it that once you feel that you're safe, you don't have to worry about the other as a threat, and then you can be friends? Or what is it that makes the difference?
The difference is knowing their story, and because again, we're wired for story. That's mm-hmm. something that I harp on again and again because it's true. Neurologically, when we hear a story, read a story, see a story, we put ourselves in the shoes of that character, and our mirror neurons fire, and we, at some neurological level, are experiencing life as that person. If we know other people's stories, it can be through newspaper articles, it can be through blog posts, it can be through webcams, it can be through, you know, whatever the technology, suddenly we start taking their point of view. Now, it's not that we abrogate our belief system. It's not that we ignore whatever moral constructs we were raised with. It's just that for that moment, we understand why they are the way they are. And I think that's the more stories that can be told, the more effective this, you know, kind of global empathy can be.
And so technology has just been tremendously empowering in
by telling those
allowing
stories.
Us to tell our stories to each other.
Yes.
And suddenly we can see each other as characters in these stories and have empathy for each other. And
yes.
It's a better world.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Facebook, of all things. It's pretty amazing to think about that. Well, I've got an even wackier answer than Facebook. My next set of two is Skype, astoundingly enough, Stephen, and Audacity. Now, Skype, I say astoundingly. Did we talk about this on the air, or was it before the show last week?
It was Skype. Before the show. No, this is
before
all
the
this
show.
Is all new. Yeah, we complain about Skype a lot.
We
know,
have complained
sort of
about Skype a lot. There was a time when a Google search for Skype sucks, the words, quote, Skype sucks, would bring the Speculist up in the first page, and I believe at one time we were the number one entry for that.
Good job, guys.
I know, huh? Yeah. Awesome. It, through no planning or anything, I just happened to write a piece called Skype Sucks, and it rose to the top through the magic of, you know, people agreeing with that sentiment. So that's why it's remarkable that I'm now listing Skype as one of the reasons that I'm optimistic about the future. But I want to throw Skype out there, and I throw Audacity out there. Tremendous improvements in how Skype performs over the years. I mean, part of my complaint about Skype at that time was the business management side of the management side of the business. The fact that they would like take your money away from you, and I think Stephen, you're still kind of bitter about that. Is that right?
Oh yeah, yeah. The bitterness runs deep.
As am I, but the fact that the technology has so enabled people to communicate with each other. You know, my wife and my 2-year-old daughter every Saturday evening are on video Skype with my in-laws in Malaysia, and she gets to see her cousins. And you know, you think about this—the world connected via video phones. This Arthur C. Clarke future that we thought was never going to get here, and now suddenly it's like, oh, it's here, and we've hardly even noticed.
It's enabled a hugely funny thing on one of my favorite shows, The Big Bang Theory, Raj and his parents. You know, that's like an ongoing joke. You know, it's they're in India, but they're still impacting their son via video Skype. You know,
absolutely. He just opened the laptop, and there were both his parents interacting with him as though he were in the next room rather than half the planet away. It truly is an ability for people to connect over and above or alongside, I guess, PJ, I should say, with the social networking technology that you mentioned. So I'm really optimistic about the future based on what I've seen happen with Skype. And I want to throw Audacity in there too. Audacity being this, it's been in beta forever, free audio editing software that Stephen and I used to use to kind of handcraft the fast forward radio back before we had Blog Talk Radio. I use Audacity.
We were still inventing the podcast. You know, we were.
Yeah, we invented that. That's right. We did. We totally invented the podcast. We don't get enough credit for that. But I was recording an installment of the Transparency Revolution the other day. I've got my Skype recorder and I've got Audacity to do the editing after the fact. And this gentleman I was talking to, it was a great interview, wonderful discussion, and someone was like mowing the lawn or aerating the lawn or something like right outside the window where he was. And so as we're talking, you got this just constantly in the background, and there was no place else for him to be. It's not like he can go hide in a closet or something. He's in his office, you know, he's on Skype. So I'm like, that's okay. I think I can do something about that after the fact. Have I told this story?
No.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I don't want to spend too much time on it if I've already told it. So I get the Skype recording back. I open it up in Audacity, you know, these two like essentially free pieces of software. And sure enough, I'm talking. I sound fine. Every time he's talking in the background, it's like, you know, just I'm like, that won't work. So I sampled a pause, of just that sound. And I went into the noise filter and I said, filter this out. It filtered it out. And he sounded fine. It was like nothing had ever, you know, there was nothing there. And you think about how tremendously sophisticated that capability is.
Wow.
that, and it just, you know, you can download it for free. And to be able to do something like that that was, you know, would have been impossible or would have taken thousands of human hours to do even just a few years ago, and, you know, you do it with the click of a button. Now, unfortunately, that noise was right in my vocal range, so he sounded fine, and I sounded exactly like Mickey Mouse. In fact, I wish I had saved the whole recording, so I had to go back through and, like, drop my pitch and lower my speed for every time I talked, because I came out sounding like Mickey Mouse. But it's still just amazing that we are empowered with technologies that at one time would have belonged only to, as we've talked about so many times, large groups of people, or that just simply didn't exist, and now they exist at a click of a button. And I'm tremendously optimistic about that. Michael gives us an example that I'm having a little struggle with, so Michael, you might want to clarify this in the chat room, but he mentions food production. Let me read this off to you guys, and you tell me if this makes you optimistic or if I'm misreading it, okay? He's giving some stats from the World Health Organization. He says that in 1979, the population of the world was 5.4 billion, and approximately 850 million were living in hunger. Then, in 2009, the population was 6.8 billion, and approximately 1 billion living in hunger. And he says, meaning in 1979 it was a distribution problem, not a production problem, though there are probably some areas where the excess human labor is necessary to increase production. So, sorry, Michael, I'm not following why that, you know, it seems like there's more hungry people now. Is it the proportion that makes that optimistic? I don't know. Comments from either of you on that one?
I think that the reason I'm optimistic about food production is GM foods. I'm hopeful that those that you know protest and get out there and you know destroy experimental GM crops will get a grip and realize that this is the way we're going to feed ourselves in the future. And I'm optimistic that we can feed ourselves, and that specifically is the reason why.
Well,
I've always been under the impression that in terms of food production, it has always been a distribution problem, that it actually has never been about a production problem. And so I'm a little curious about his figures. There are a number of people who are experts in this who believe that, you know, we're actually, if you look at all the food that is produced, we're actually producing enough to feed everyone. It's just
right.
Getting the food to everyone and getting through corrupt governmental systems, et cetera.
Absolutely. And in fact, in the chat room, in all caps, Michael says it's a distribution problem. So no reason to shout, Michael. You're recovering from a cold. And Sally points out the ratio is lower. Okay, so I didn't pick up on it immediately, but I agree that the fact that the ratio is lower and we seem, therefore, are apparently doing better at distributing than we did in the past. And I wonder, PJ, if that might have something to do with the increase in empathy in the world. I wonder if, as that goes up, if the distribution of food might improve.
That's very true. A good question.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our third item. We're running desperately low on time, Stephen, so I think you got a quick, snappy one for us, right?
Absolutely. How about this? E-books. I'm optimistic about the future because, we're all walking around with libraries in our pockets now. And not just a library, but also a bookstore. You know, have ideas. You know, again, this is a little bit like PJ, your idea, where you know we challenge ourselves when we meet people with different ideas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Books are a way of accomplishing that. And you know, while we read a book, we basically are trying on someone else's idea and seeing what of it we find, you know, is explanatory for the problems and perhaps in our own lives or the things that we see. And we keep what we like, and we toss with some of it, and we incorporate it into our worldview. Well, the more that we're able to do that, the better. And reading can and is becoming a social endeavor. I mean, when every chapter of a book has its own chat room, and you're reading it live with other people that are also reading it, and you're commenting back and forth. When we get to that point, and we're not quite there yet, but when we do, then that's going to be huge, and things like that are possible with e-books. So,
I'm optimistic because of ebooks.
Are you really going to mention this without talking about our bet?
I'm optimistic I'm going to win our bet. So there you are.
You know, we mentioned it briefly last week, but why don't you remind the audience what our bet was?
Okay, I believe, if I say it wrong, Phil correct me. But we bet, it was about 2 or 3 years ago that, in 5 years or something like that, we put a number on it, more e-books would be sold than paper books, and that paper books would actually take a hit. There'd be fewer paper books being printed. And you said, no, I think that that e-books will be outselling paper books, but there'll be more paper books than ever.
That was my prediction. My prediction was that that e-books would take off tremendously, but it would not impact the sale of paper books. And as Sally points out in the chat room, Amazon is now selling more e-books than dead tree books. And we see bookstores closing, sadly, all over the place. So I have to concede that you have won that $1 bet, Stephen.
Yes. As soon as we get together, I intend to collect. But there was an interesting thing I read here in the last week. It was a bookstore that's setting up a system to print on demand books. Basically, if you come in there and you want some book that's been out of print for 20 years, oh, that's no problem. We have the digital copyright here. Why don't you walk around the store for a few minutes? We'll have a paperback version ready for you in 30 minutes or whatever. That's pretty cool. Make every bookstore capable of providing you a paper copy of every single book that's ever been seen the light of day. I mean, that's where this thing could eventually go. I mean, and that's great for people who prefer to read their books on paper too. So.
Right. Well, you know, can you go in there with your Kindle and say, "I'd like this one," right? I already own it on my Kindle. I'd like to have a hard copy. I wonder
why not? You know, so exactly.
Well, I think that is good reason to be optimistic. It's just so wonderful, actually, to be able to. You know what finally sold me on ebooks was the zero wait time to get a book.
Exactly. We would mention a book on this show, and I would already have it downloaded before the end of the show. You know, we have a guest talking about some book. You guys really need to read such and such a book. And I have it ready.
Yeah, Stephen's going, I downloaded it while you were talking about it. I've just sped read it, and now I've put a review up and give it 3.5 stars. Always showing off, mister. But it really is. It really is. It's amazing how fast you can access the information now, and that you can have an entire book as soon as you want it. I mean, that's just so cool. It overwhelms any objections I ever had to books in any other form. I see in the chat room, Michael says, "Yeah, this is good news, but I like paper." It's like, you know what? I like paper too, but I like having a book when I want it, and I like having this entire library with me all the time. It's very much like what happened with music. We see the same thing happening with books. What do you think, PJ? You big on e-books?
Oh yeah, I think they're fantastic for all the reasons you both said. And just even seeing how quickly my children, especially my daughter who has a Kindle, adapted to using it, it's extraordinary. You know, the thing, until she dropped it and the screen froze, which means I need to call Amazon now and have to figure out what they can do for her poor little Kindle. I mean, you know, that was glued to her body. Constantly reading whatever she was downloading next. And I love that. I mean, how can you not love your children reading?
Yeah, that's great. There you go. That's the reason.
Another story on the same subject, Bill. Sorry. 98% of college students with a digital device regularly read e-textbooks. And any parent that's paying for their kids to go to college would appreciate that textbooks are just hugely overpriced.
Outrageously
though. What's a textbook run these days? I wouldn't be surprised.
I don't even want to know. It's like, Hannah would come back for the textbook thing, and I'm just like, what? How many books are you getting? You know, and she'd say, I don't know, three. It's just they're all each one is like hundreds of dollars. It's outrageous.
Yeah.
Also, just carrying the textbooks with kids in high school, their backpacks weigh 40 pounds.
Exactly.
Crazy, and they're dragging those things around every day, all day. I love that they could just stick it all on an iPad and be done with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's just so much easier and more compact. I mean, the analogy to having an iPod versus carrying 20, racks of CDs around, right? It's so much easier. Okay, PJ, I didn't mean to skip your turn. Did you have a third item?
Well, I have the obvious item, but then I have the not obvious item, and I'm really torn. I really want someone other than me to talk about sustainable energy because I'm really optimistic about that. I think solar is taking off very quickly in terms of dropping a price below what we create energy at using fossil fuels. But I really don't want to talk about that.
We won't have any discussion of that.
You guys can talk about that.
The fact that sustainable renewable energy is really taking off will not be mentioned this evening.
No. You guys, please feel free.
What
I'd really like to talk about, because this is something that has been coming up on Facebook quite a bit, is, and I think it's very thematic to what you're going to be experiencing very soon, Phil, with your impending new daddy-dom.
All right.
Is having kids, because I'm very optimistic every time a child is born. I think that children are what are going to get us out of the hole, that if we are digging ourselves holes, they're the ones who are going to be getting us out of the holes. However, I discovered that on Facebook among my younger friends, the 20-somethings who are terribly smart and terribly ambitious and terribly forward-thinking, that almost none of them either have kids or want kids because they themselves are pessimistic about the future that has kids in them. And I'm appalled by this because it strikes me that some very able people who I know would make absolutely gorgeous, adorable, wonderful, intelligent children don't want to have them because of fear, because of pessimism.
Right.
And I have nothing against people not wanting to have children. In fact, there are lots of people who should not have children.
Should not have children. I think we can all agree on that, yes.
But, to simply not want them because of fear of the future strikes me as self-destructive. I think back to the story Children of Men. And what happens when people lose that optimism and stop having kids? Now, of course, in Children of Men, they stopped having kids because of some biological reason that made everyone sterile. But,
right.
To voluntarily stop having children, to me, is the most pessimistic act possible. And if any of you are listening out there tonight, please rethink this this situation, because it's ultimately self-destructive.
I could not agree more. I follow some of these discussion threads too, and I'm always so surprised to see that that attitude, that kind of set of beliefs about having children. For one thing, it seems that you argue with your own existence when you do that.
Yes.
It's like, I'm glad my parents had at least this one kid, right? I mean, don't you like being here? Don't you like being alive? The next group in line is going to feel the same way, I think. You're not giving them credit for making their own decision about whether it's going to be a good future or a bad future, for one thing. And, that goes so well with your earlier point. It just seems that we've intellectualized ourselves out of our own optimistic nature in some areas, haven't we?
Yes. Yes, and while optimism may not always be rational, that isn't to say that it isn't necessary. I believe it's incredibly necessary. And I really hope that this mindset is simply an indication of a lack of life experience, possibly. I don't want to say immaturity because many of these people are mature for their age,
mm-hmm.
but I would say a lack of ironically, a bigger context of what having that child might mean.
Absolutely. You know, and I think your initial answer really just sums up so much. Children are a great reason to be optimistic. If you have them, if you spend any time with them, if you have children in your life, then you get to witness this kind of forward progression of life, this kind of, you know, development from a simpler form to a more complex form, this taking on of the kind of the fullness that is human personhood. And it's the most astounding privilege in the world to get to witness that, to get to be a part of that. And it's a terrible shame to think of people depriving themselves of that experience and at the same time, I think selling their own future short and our next generation's future short. So you obviously have taken one of my answers, my last answer, and I'm gonna not only agree with you, PJ, but you've sold me on the idea of having children so much that I'm gonna have two. Okay.
And you're so sold, you're gonna have one the end of this week.
That's right. I'm going right out on Friday. I want to thank my wife for participating in this. She's kind of a bit player in all this, but we're very excited that we've got two children. And in fact, that was my number one answer. I'm very optimistic about the future because of the future that I see in children and in my own children and in other people's children and just, you know, the kind of hope they bring. And, you know, I think that's the message is that, you know, your kid, whoever you are, who have decided you're too afraid to have kids, your kid could be the one that solves all the problems.
Exactly,
you know,
right.
You're aware of the problems. Your child, you know, or their kid could be the one who solves them all. So,
and given the backgrounds of some of these people who apparently are so afraid of having children, their children are precisely the people who could be solving these problems.
Yeah.
Which I find sad and ironic and upsetting.
Yep.
Yes,
yep.
And yet somehow typical. Although people, you know, we are talking about very young people. Sometimes people do change their minds about those things as they get older. So I'm optimistic about that as well. I'm going to end it with Michael, who takes us to an even more spiritual and optimistic realm. What makes Stephen? Any idea what makes Michael optimistic? His number one answer.
I don't want to hazard a guess. Let's hear it, though.
Cubs fans, last championship 1908, and yet the love of the fans, the hope just won't go away. We wait, we hope for better pitching and some clutch hitting, but we all know it's going to happen. Well, on that very happy note, I'm going to say thank you very much for being with us, PJ. Stephen, look forward to listening to the program over the next few weeks, and I look forward to being back with everyone for The World Transformed at the end of the month. What's our music this evening?
Before we go to the music, real quick, I wanted to say I want to put the summer reading list that I thought was a pretty awesome summer reading list of the kind of books that, you know, a speculative person would like to read. I'm putting that in the chat room, and we'll also make sure it makes the post as well. Our music tonight is And It Begins by Marquis Adora.
Great choice. And It Begins by Marquis Adora. Thanks for putting that together. Thank you, PJ, for being with us. Great chat going on tonight, Michael. Awesome to have you back. And everyone who listened live, everyone who's part of Fast Forward Radio, thanks for listening to the program. I'm going to try to be on with The World Transformed Saturday night. No promises, but Stephen will definitely be back with the live show 1 week from tonight. Hope you'll be able to join us for all of our upcoming programs. And until next time, live to see it.
We try so hard to survive. The entertainer, no fingers or eyes. Beneath the surface, the ocean we rise. Tied up again in nets and with fact that you want to be the only source of love that I wish to see. Right.